This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 61. And very excited today. We're going to be talking about vulnerability, shame, scarcity mindset, and doing all of this in spaces like social media with Rebecca Ching, a marriage and family therapist, leadership consultant, speaker, all of the above, entrepreneur Rebecca Ching. And what's kind of drove this conversation is a few weeks ago in my Dr. Chris Hoff Instagram feed, I posted a quote by Rachel Alea that said, the quote said, "What if we were transparent about our own failures, not as some kind of performative vulnerability, but as an invitation to collectively destigmatize the messy process of lifelong learning?" And this post got a huge response. I mean, I got DM'd by a bunch of people. It seemed to really resonate with people. It seemed that people were speaking to a frustration about what Rachel Alea is calling performative vulnerability, or Brené Brown might call fake vulnerability. And it just created a lot of traction. And one of the respondents was Rebecca Ching. And I asked her if she'd be willing, because she's so familiar with the work of Brené Brown and has done a lot of stuff around Brené Brown's work, and if she'd be willing to come on and we could talk about vulnerability. And so this is what we're doing today. And we're going to be doing it with Rebecca Ching, who is a therapist, speaker, writer, leadership consultant, and workshop facilitator. She is the CEO and founder of Potentia Family Therapy, which is a brick-and-mortar integrated mental health practice based in San Diego, California. She is also starting a new venture working with business leaders where she helps them navigate the intersection of mindset and mental health in their communities via her integrated leadership collective based on systems theory, the research of Brené Brown, and internal family systems. Prior to working as a therapist, she worked in Washington, D.C. for a United States senator, in New York City as an advertising account executive, and in Zurich, Switzerland as an area director for an international youth organization. All of her previous professional experience fuels her clinical and consultation work today. She lives in San Diego, California with her husband and their two children, where they enjoy cooking and going to farmers markets, all things ocean and outdoor sports. And so without further ado, let's meet Rebecca. All right. Welcome to the show, Rebecca. Very glad to have you here.
So thrilled to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Yes, thanks. Okay, let's get rolling. I guess I should say that the reason we kind of are having this conversation was that a few weeks back, I posted a quote on Instagram or my Instagram feed where it was a quote that some people might be familiar with. Rachel Alea said something to the effect that, "What if we were transparent about our own failures, not as some kind of performative vulnerability, but as an invitation to collectively destigmatize the messy process of lifelong learning?" I then, I posted that up, and then I wrote some comments under the quote that I would love to have Brené Brown on the podcast to discuss the rise of performative vulnerability on social media. And I offered some questions that I would be curious about that included, you know, what can be the effects of this kind of vulnerability on transparency, and can this performative vulnerability actually strengthen shame, and what relational effects might it engender, and what would some of her thoughts be about this? And the feedback I received from this post was like really eye-opening. It seemed that it really hit a nerve. I mean, I got a lot of DMs, I had people messaging me, and then there was this sort of kind of this backlash against what Rachel Alea calls performative vulnerability. I know it maybe has other names. Brené Brown might call it fake vulnerability in social media spaces. And it seemed that people were a bit tired of it. And so I know this is a lot of territory to cover, and I want to thank you for kind of being my Brené Brown stand-in for this conversation. And I think before we get started, it might be helpful to share with the audience a bit about your background and kind of what context you work in, et cetera.
Absolutely. And I was one of those people that chimed in on the post, which I think led to our conversation today. But I am going on my 16th year as a licensed, I've been licensed the whole time, I'm practicing psychotherapist, licensed marriage and family therapist for almost 14 now. I own and lead an integrative mental health practice here in San Diego called Potentia Family Therapy. Like many colleagues, I dove in and got a lot of areas of specialty. So I'm also a certified Daring Way facilitator, which is part of Brené Brown's training group, but also a consultant. So when people are getting certified, I get to work with them in the certification process. I'm a licensed or a certified internal family systems therapist, certified eating disorder specialist and supervisor, and also a certified EMDR therapist. So all in. I'm also a double AMFT approved supervisor. So passionate about diving deep and developing specialties.
Great. Maybe to get started, you could share some of your thoughts about why vulnerability. I mean, vulnerability obviously is so important, but I'm wondering why you think it's important or what function it serves and maybe how you work with it in the therapeutic setting.
Right. And everything I'm referencing is based on Brené Brown's research as it informs everything I do professionally and personally. It really is integrated into my life. And I will also note that I do it deeply, deeply and perfectly in the process as I'm deeply, deeply human. So vulnerability is everything. It is ground zero for everything. Our ability to tolerate what Brené calls risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure, the three components of what she defines as vulnerability. Our ability to hang out in that space without armoring up or protecting, numbing out, disengaging, all of the various things that you and I do with our clients and in our leadership work to help people stay in that place without armoring up. If we can tolerate that risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure, and a very key note is if anyone is vulnerable, they're not comfortable. So I know if I hear someone said, oh my gosh, Rebecca, I was so vulnerable today. It was so awesome. I'm very confident they weren't vulnerable based on this definition. So I think we have an epidemic of misunderstanding what Brené is talking about in terms of vulnerability. And she addressed that head on in Rising Strong and also in Dare to Lead. So vulnerability and our capacity to tolerate that is the bridge to the things that we desire most, whether it's love, belonging, creativity, faith, innovation, the things that give us life, the things that take us on our path to have our dreams come true, the place where we feel that confidence and that flow in life and very aligned with the things that matter. So it's an interesting tension because if you're in a place of risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure, your brain is immediately wanting to shut it all down because it's dangerous. I mean, vulnerability is dangerous to our brains. So there's this immediate hyper millisecond kind of thing that goes on in our inner systems when we tap into vulnerability. And so this is a real nuanced practice. And for me, I don't know what I'd be doing without my shame resilience practice. So I can stay in that space of vulnerability and be able to circle back with integrity when I mess up, which is frequently. So this piece on, for me, putting any words around vulnerability means that it's not vulnerability. So performative vulnerability means it's not vulnerability. It's hot wiring connection. It's an agenda. It's, I don't know what else it may be. But based on Brené's research, I see all these different ways of labeling it positively or negatively. And if you care about something deeply or someone deeply, you are vulnerable. So there's no opting out of it if you have that caring. And if you have the capacity for love, which is most of us, as you and I both know, there might be a small percentage that aren't capable of that. But for the most part, We are vulnerable because we are all in with those that are those that we love, those that we serve, the missions that we're passionate about. So, and that's really can be exhausting and painful at times. So we need to have practices in to tolerate it. But I think we also need to get really clear on what it is and what it isn't. And just one more thing, I want to just note what Brené wrote on page 35 in Dare to Lead. On this exact topic, she wrote, "I am not a proponent of oversharing indiscriminate disclosure as a leadership tool, as a clinical tool too, or vulnerability for vulnerability's sake." So just sit on that. And then number two, she wrote, "There is no daring leadership without vulnerability."
Yeah.
So there's that tension. So yeah. I'll leave that there with you.
Yeah. And I like that tension. I like those spaces. And I was wondering, I guess, in the book Dare to Lead, which I am really enjoying. I'm actually more than halfway through it now because I picked it up in preparation for this conversation. And I actually read her first book, her very, very first book, and back in the day, and really enjoyed that as well. But I guess she does do some myth busting around, and I had some misconceptions, I think, as well about maybe how she approached vulnerability, but she acknowledges in the book that there has been some misconceptions about her work around vulnerability, and stated that vulnerability doesn't equal disclosure. And she calls out fake vulnerability and that vulnerability is not a marketing tool. It's not an oversharing strategy, which you said, and which I think kind of that's where the energy around my post came from. But people were seeing the marketing aspect of vulnerability.
Oh, yes.
And I'm wondering if, you know, how can we maybe spot fake vulnerability, or do you have some ideas about how it's being used in some of these social media spaces as a way of kind of marketing?
Yeah, it was interesting. I just heard feedback a week ago from someone whose boss told her that she just had to be more vulnerable.
Oh my gosh.
ask her how she defines vulnerability. I said, circle back with your boss on that. You know, I think with Brené's work and other thought leaders that are overlapping with her work right now, we're finding the power of empathy and the power of self-compassion, and the power of vulnerability. We are so hungry for that connection and to feel that kind of me too. I'm not alone in this, right? This common humanity piece. We also have become deeply sick, physically, emotionally, spiritually sick because we haven't been able to tolerate vulnerability. And so I see a lot in, especially in the online marketing space, where now they want a hotwire connection. And that's what it is. Because if I'm doing something vulnerable, let's say I'm creating a program or an offering or putting out a new website or something like that, I have my feelings of vulnerability, but if I go on and just detail the play-by-play while I'm still in the middle of it, and I'm not honest about my agendas, like if I'm thinking, oh, this is a teaching opportunity because my community is doing the same way. But most of the time, and what Brené, I love how she calls stealth intentions and stealth expectations. Yeah. I mean, we call it meaning and motivation, right? What's the meaning of my sharing and what's the motivation of it? But, if we're not really clear, if it's like, I want to build more of a following, I want to make more sales, I want to get more likes, it's not vulnerability. It's just not. It's manipulation. Mm-hmm. It's hotwiring connection. And it's setting both the person sharing and the audience up for failure and for pain and for confusion. It's not a way to lead. I think when I see leaders share something like, you know what, a year ago, I had all this stuff going on. Here are my 5 key learnings. And they share some personal things like, you know, my marriage was really hard. We went to therapy. My health got out of sorts and I made these changes. So they're sharing some personal things when they've worked through it, but they're not sharing the private stuff. They didn't go into the play-by-play details of the nuances in their marriage. And I think some people like that, but honestly, we're in such a voyeuristic culture.
Yeah, seriously.
And it creates a false sense of intimacy and connection. And that also, I think, sets us up for failure. And I don't think this is hard. In fact, I think there's just sometimes, and again, with thought leaders like Brené, when they're like, you know, taking a stand on what's going on in our culture regarding, I remember she did this amazing Facebook Live right after the marches happened in Virginia. It was like a year ago, August, about 18 months ago, when the white nationalists marched. And she just went out there and she was calling it as it was. It was a Facebook Live and it was powerful. It was educational and it was tender because this is a very volatile topic. That was very vulnerable in the moment response. And she was leading well because it was very much aligned with her core values. She was daring to be vulnerable, hoping the outcome would be that there'd be some folks that would learn, that would rethink some things, also maybe feel supported and encouraged. But she wasn't, she's doing this because she couldn't not do it because of her core values. And she's in that arena and wasn't going to listen to all the, oh, you're to play it safe and you might lose some book sales and some people might not want to work with you anymore if you're calling this out this way. She was like, no, this is more important. So that's vulnerable, where the outcome, she doesn't know how that could impact her personally or professionally. But she did it because it absolutely was aligned with what matters. And I think maybe some people would say this business has to get in the world because this does matter. But I feel like if we're looking at profit over mission and money over mission, sales over mission, if you know, then that's where the things get out of sorts too. So I really do think we have a fundamental in the online marketing space misuse of the words vulnerability, authenticity, empathy, and compassion. They are getting used and you can't hotwire it because if you're not doing your own work, if you're not able to sit with discomfort, if you don't have good boundaries, knowing what's okay and what's not okay, and you don't get clear on your agendas and your core values, then it's really hard to say that was vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think people can sense it in some ways. Would you agree or like?
Yes. I think you alluded to that at the beginning. Yeah. I think oftentimes, and maybe this is more subjective, Chris, but for me, I'll read something and I'll kind of go, I'll feel this cringeworthy, like, oh, I didn't need to hear all that. That wasn't, no one asked me. Now I can't unread this. And yet there's other times where I'm like, whoa, that was intense. And this is causing me to think. And that's the nuance of it, right? But yeah, we do feel it. And I feel like we are getting more and more savvy to manipulation. And that the other side of this, though, is then we're closing up to the beauty of vulnerability and we're missing out on that and kind of leading and living from a cynical, armored up place. And that's horrible, too.
Yeah, and I'm that leads us into really my next question. I'm glad you brought that up, and that is my that's my concern. Even bringing this forward, and being kind of critical of it in the post at the same time, I'm even in my own life, I'm trying to fight this cynicism, right?
And, fight it, Chris. We need you.
and I've been thinking like the last month, I've been thinking a lot about this, that there is a cynicism that's creeped into my own life, and I'm kind of chewing on that a little bit, but that
it's a powerful protector. It's a powerful protector to say, I don't just trust anybody. Everyone just wants something from me. It shuts it down, right?
It's just not the way I want to move through the world. And
me neither.
Okay. But that you did raise the point about, that it can, this kind of other kind of vulnerability, can create the cynicism or the shutting down or the armoring up. And so maybe we can get to some of the questions I had from my original post and when this sort of vulnerability shows up on our social media feeds. And I guess the first one, well, I'll go over them and maybe you can take them on. But, you know, how might this affect transparency, right? This connection or this kind of other kind of way of doing vulnerability. And what effects might it have on trust? And can this performative or fake vulnerability actually strengthen shame? And what relational effects might it engender? Will it be generative or will it kind of shut people down? And you kind of talked about that, but maybe you can take those on a little bit.
Yeah. Well, first I want to make sure for me, there isn't any other kind of vulnerability, right? It's either vulnerability or something else. I really think we need to shift that conversation.
Okay, got it. Yep.
And that's just my two cents on it because I think it's really confusing to the consumer, to the folks out there. And transparency, I think it can totally build trust when the agenda is aligned with cultivating, whether it's culture, if it's building relationship. You know, Brené's famous for kind of writing and talking about vulnerability isn't live tweeting your bikini wax, right? That's not the kind of, I mean, some people might enjoy that,
yeah, right.
I guess. Yeah. And again, we're in a world that's, here's the thing too. I think the people that might enjoy that are also falling prey to an epidemic of dehumanization, where we're forgetting to see kind of the precious element of life in each person, something sacred about that. And where there's just something's transactional and we're losing our sense of humanity and seeing the humanity in others and sometimes ourselves. So if I'm being transparent with my team saying, hey, I'm making some decisions, this is why I'm stopping this and starting this. Let me know if you have any questions, or, hey, I'm bringing somebody new on the team. Here's what my thoughts are. If you have any concerns or questions, you know, inviting conversation, which is vulnerable, because they might tell me that my ideas are totally wrong. And that would just annoy me because I'm, you know, I've got my vision. So, but if I'm being transparent to the point where I didn't ask like if it feels like my agenda is, I'm going to share with you all my stuff, all my complicated, messy stuff, so that one, maybe you'll feel more open to sharing with me, or two, we'll just put it all out there. And if we're not going to connect, then at least you'll know all of the deep, dark stuff about me. And that's armor. That's not vulnerability. That's shame led. That's fear and scarcity led. So this performative piece is with an agenda that's not aligned with core values. That's not aligned with what's okay and what's not okay, as Brené defines vulnerability. It's not aligned with permission. So social media is interesting because, you know, I follow you, Chris. You gave me permission to follow you. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I also have permission to unfollow. So there is that element in social, right?
Yeah. Right.
And it's something I don't think we exercise enough. I've started to regularly go through my feed just to see how's that feeling, because I'm trying to protect that. Because you and I know the research is so clear about mood and social media. So right, I'm really trying to cultivate that well. So transparency, if we're not clear on goals, if we're not clear on our core values, again, our meaning and motivation, or as Brené calls stealth intentions and stealth expectations, then it's not transparency. There's an agenda there that is not necessarily altruistic. Now, trust is something that's built in small moments, something that Brené talked about extensively and Daring Greatly in her research there. It's not this, I'm going to tell it all stuff. It's, you know, I've been following you for a while now, Chris, and you know, you show up consistently, your message is consistent, your curiosity is consistent, you share bits of your life, and there's trust. I'm like, oh, this is a professional who cares deeply about mind-body stuff. Oh my gosh, really wise, cares about investing in our profession. So that's where I've built trust. So when you say, hey, do you want to come on my podcast? I'm like, duh, yes, I'd be honored. So it's these small moments of consistency. And you know, they talk about that online, like consistency is king, and it really is. But are we being consistent, or all of a sudden you've been sharing images of the beach and your food, and all of a sudden here's a tell-all of your story because you're getting ready to launch something, or just you're needing some affirmation? It's something to be cautious of. And you're absolutely, I think, right on. And it's coming from a place where shame. It says, you know, that Brené defines it as the intensely painful feeling or fear of not being worthy of love and belonging. So it's the absolute thing that we're desperate for. A connection is oxygen for our soul, I often say. And when we panic, we can't breathe. Right. We kind of flail. So I think we flail sometimes in our in-person and online relationships when we're feeling disconnected. And we're in a very disconnected culture, and shame and fear, scarcity, blame, disconnection, they're having a party. And most often this transparency, what people are calling transparency, is coming out of those places. And I do think we're numbing up because it's painful, and people are feeling more and more emboldened to not, it's kind of, how do I say this? It is, there's more permission to be bold about views and beliefs and about people who look different, believe different, show up in life differently, and to do that in very violent, degrading, dehumanizing ways. And that's almost become this homeostasis. So of course our nervous systems are protecting. Of course they are. It's trauma. It is trauma. And it's these little T's and big T traumas. So it makes sense that people are shutting down and numbing in ways. And often we numb by offloading our pain by just becoming a critic or a cynic.
Yeah, I can identify with that. So so then how might we do real connection in these spaces that make it hard to do real connection? And can it be done? You know, I'm speaking maybe specifically to social media, but although I think there's a lot of you and I are connected now via social, right? So connection can happen, but so I don't want to single story it, but I'm wondering if you have some ideas about how we can do real connection in these spaces.
Yeah, and I'll be the first to say, Chris, I think there's some really beautiful things about social. Yeah. I think there's just, it's a new horizon for our generation, for my kids, but it's a shift for how we connected. But I think we have to balance online and in real life connection. We have to integrate both. And when that is impossible, get on Zoom calls. Mm-hmm. And I love the DM feature of Instagram. I have met and gotten to know so many cool people deepened relationships. I think we also have to be really selective of who's speaking into our lives. Mm. And are we wanting to connect with people so that we feel enough? Or is it just like, oh my gosh, I really value your work. I want to know more. Mm. Or that post really spoke to me. And I think there is something to comment and say positive things, whether it's a DM or in the feed, and just connecting with genuine curiosity. If we're just reacting and offloading, that doesn't build connection. And so I think it is just slower is faster. Now I feel like I'm a minority now, but I'm a pretty strong extrovert. Mm. So I love all this stuff, but I also talk to my introverted friends and colleagues and leaders, and they love this one-on-one connection online too. But it really is important to find that balance of in real life, online, and also just to disconnect in general.
That's great.
We need to do that.
Yeah. And which I've been trying a little of that myself, the disconnecting part, because I actually put the clock on my iPhone to see how much time I'm spending on it.
I've been a little hearing shocking that from
at
people.
First. Yeah.
Yeah. And if people are really making some shifts from that, I think that's really important. I'm glad they put that tool on there.
Yeah, it's great. Okay. So for, you know, our audience, the therapists, social workers, and counselors that are listening and building practices and online presences, or an online presence, what might you suggest to them in doing vulnerability?
Well, I know that they already are because they're in the helping profession.
Sure.
And that they need to give themselves a lot of credit. And we can't give what we don't have. And so if we're going to navigate this hyper online connected culture that's also increasingly fosters competition and scarcity, I mean, here in Southern California, I mean, there are so many therapists and there's so many people that I have to tell. I mean, I'm in San Diego, so I tell my team, there are 3 million people here. I think there's 20 people for each of you. You know, we're good. We just got to let the word out. Yeah. You know, so I feel like self-care is not a platitude. It has to be a deep core value in action. And we have to catch the scarcity and competition and, you know, to other therapists and what other people are doing. We have to find our own voice, just like we find with our theoretical orientation. Mm. We're defining our voice as a leader in the clinical community. Cause I mean, let's be honest, Chris, I've really come to the conclusion that for the most part, we have masters and PsyDs and PhDs in scarcity, like how to keep our license.
Yeah.
We don't.
Seriously.
So the more that I've been digging in and working with folks in our field and obviously diving into Brené's work and seeing this huge dissonance and internal family systems deeply informs me too. And going, wow, I know more. There's parts of me that are like, don't, if someone is really struggling, I have to do all of these things out of fear and scarcity versus just be, I lose my presence with them. Mm. Doesn't mean I'm not ethical or legal by all means. So I feel like we have to not work in isolation. My goodness, yes. Stay in community. That's one of the things about our team. We meet weekly. And they didn't have to. We meet weekly and gather weekly because we want community. We don't want isolation. We want support. And that's how we stay out of the, in California, we have a magazine called The Therapist. And yeah. They have this, used to be in the middle. We called it the centerfold. Now it's in the back of all these people's names and what they did to lose their license, which is horrible. Yeah. But that's still so burned in my system. So I think that you are doing vulnerability if you're in a helping profession. And it's a profession that has a hard reputation. Our reputation has taken a big hit. The more that I see all these laws and regulations, the more it means there's people in our field that have messed up that they have to, you know, put a law out. So, you know, I really want to call our community to call all of us up even more with our standards and our ethics, but also not shy away from creativity and innovation. That is always keeping the client in mind and also doing things in our life that are really filling our cup and living life. And we're not taught to do that in grad school and in our traineeships and often in our internships. It's work, work, work. Mm. So I think that it's really getting clear on why we're doing what we're doing, not staying isolated. And when we're catching ourselves comparing to other folks that seem to be so successful, you know, to put a pause on that, but find community within the colleagues that are wanting to, you know, maybe take your business to the next level, but also not to sacrifice laws and ethics in the name of, you know, if you know, when you're trying to get out there, don't hustle for it because it not only hurts you and your clients, but our field.
Sure. And can you say I'm really interested in this idea of scarcity, and I know you talk about this, and I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about the scarcity mindset and how it plays out maybe in our field specifically.
Yeah, and thank you for asking that, because I think it's important to differentiate between real scarcity, which I know people feel. It's just horrible that we're asking people to work for free in grad school while they're paying grad school, right? And so there's real scarcity of trying to pay the bills and now pay their loans. And if they're in private practice or even working at an agency, keeping up with everything and still trying to make ends meet. So there's that real scarcity that often then can fuel the scarcity mindset that I'm not doing enough. There's not enough clients out there. There's no one... You know, I'm not that different than anybody else. You know, I'm not special enough. I'm not trained enough. I'm not specialized enough. I mean, we can go on and on. And so we can really quickly, and those inner protectors get really loud because they want to just have us keep our bar low. So the scarcity mindset really is a place for us to pause and do a U-turn and get really curious about the fears and concerns. Instead of swimming in the deep end of it and then trying to get out of it by, you know, spending thousands of dollars with some fancy guru of marketing or, you know, jumping into a specialty that really you're not passionate about. But so scarcity really, scarcity mindset is fueled by shame. It's fueled by perfectionism and it's fueled by fear. And it keeps us small and it keeps us from being brave with our clients. It's a real thing. I mean, our field is grossly underpaid and not often respected. And so those are real things. So I want to validate that. But if we're showing up at work with a scarcity mindset, like when I worked at an agency for some of my traineeship and internship hours, and I learned that here in California, the government puts in their budget money that they're going to go and take back from all of the agencies they gave it to. Like, so that's why they're saying your paperwork has to be absolutely perfect or we're going to lose money. I thought that's not a way to work when you're dealing with highly vulnerable people, deeply vulnerable people, and that are high acuity too. Mm. So I just thought, oh my goodness, that like there's an expectation that you're going to lose money each year because someone made a mistake on their paperwork who's already working tons of hours at a low fee.
Right.
Like that. So I think we got to recognize that we're in a system, but we're doing this because we're passionate about it. And we have to do our own work. Hmm. And it's the best investment we can make is on our own personal development, keep doing our own trauma work and deep soul work. That is the best gift we can give to ourselves and those that we're serving, because scarcity will just say you're too broken. And I asked my students when I was teaching practicum, I said, how many of you here have thought, who am I to be getting a master's in clinical work? Because I am such a hot mess. And, you know, they all kind of look around and then sheepishly they end up raising their hands. I said, yeah, me too. But there's two groups of people. There's the people that know that they have some hot mess to work on and they're doing the work. And there's the people that say, no, I got it all figured out, and they're not doing the work. I said, be in the first group. That's all we need.
Right. It's funny you said that. But I went to an orientation for the master's program that I eventually ended up going in. And I sat in that room and I'm like, I don't belong here. And I didn't go back for 2 years. And then,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And then went back and then, you know, had done some work and then made the plunge. But my first initial sitting was like, I don't belong here. If they knew who I was, right? And then and then I left and then I didn't go back for 2 years, but then I finally got in. So, and here I am.
Yeah. And that's what shame says. Who do you think you are? Yeah,
right.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So it took you 2 years to go back, huh?
Yeah, 2 years. Yeah.
And now look at the impact that you have, Chris. I mean, you have a nonprofit, you're teaching, you're doing leadership work. You are impacting so many people. Mm. And I think, just think if we stay small and don't show up for that. Wow.
That's right. Thank you for that. Okay. So two more final questions. And I guess this is one I like asking these days, and that's what is capturing your attention these days? And this could be ideas or books or ways of working, or, you know, what's interesting you these days?
Yeah, I mean, IFS, Internal Family Systems, is capturing me immensely. That sense that we have this innate part of us that it has the capacity to heal. And so that is really, really exciting. And I'm finding how I am less burnt out at the end of the day. I feel a lot kinder to myself, even though I've got a long way to go with that. And then the ways of working. I have been learning a lot about managing my calendar and ways of expectation. I am the queen of, like, some people... like, you know, people say, oh my gosh, my eyes are bigger than my stomach and I ate too much, right? My eyes are bigger than my calendar. And once I started calendaring everything I wanted to do, I realized my life got a lot better because I couldn't get that much done, because I still want to show up the way I want to show up with my family, with my kids, with my friends, for my health. My pace is a lot slower in what I get done. So just the idea. And then a lot of people have morning routines. And I realized for me, really getting things done, I go to bed fairly early because I get up crazy early. Just a weird genetic thing to wake up at 5 without an alarm. It's crazy.
Wow.
Not always, but it's usually really early. And it made for some lonely times in the summers as when I was a kid, because everyone was sleeping until 10 a.m. So this Mel Robbins, who is a personal development.
Yeah, I follow her, voice. Actually.
She's amazing. And she has this evening routine piece that she put out there that really was a game changer. So when I write down the three things I want to get done the next day, the dishes are done, the laundry is done, I get stuff done at night and I'm tired. And that's not been my default, because I get tired earlier. Then I wake up and I feel a lot clearer, a lot more connected and present, instead of hustling around in the morning. And then when I sit down to work, and I'm still tweaking that a little bit, but I think those are the things that have been really, really, really fun. And digging, like I said, digging deep into IFS has really helped, because unburdened some of my productivity and not enough burdens in my system have been a game changer too.
That's great. Okay. And finally, I know, how might folks get in touch with you and your work, and how can they find you after listening to this conversation?
Love that. So people can check out my practice in San Diego at www.potentiatherapy.com. And we're also at Potentia Therapy on Facebook and Instagram. So we'd love for you to follow us there and you can sign up for our email list. We're doing more and more professional development and personal development workshops and training. So we'd love to have more of your community involved. And then if people are interested in any kind of leadership work and consulting, they can reach me at RebeccaCheng.com and RebeccaCheng LMFT on Facebook and Instagram.
Awesome. And I will link that up to in the show notes, everybody, so you can find them there. And I just want to say, Rebecca, thank you for being vulnerable and coming on and having this conversation with me. It's been very informative for me, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you again for the invitation. It sure meant a lot, and really appreciate your leadership in our field and in our community. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rebecca. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. And I have stickers. If you want some Radical Therapist stickers, please shoot me an email and send me your address and all that. And I'd be happy to send out some stickers to you. I have some shirts. I have some new Radical Therapist shirts, but I think I'm holding on to them a little bit. I'm going to go up to Vancouver soon and Oakland soon. And so I think I'm going to try to round up some people to give them to. If you're there, you could, you know, let me know, and maybe I can make it happen to where I can bring you a Radical Therapist t-shirt. But if you want stickers, for sure, just shoot me an email. I'll send out some stickers. And come find me on all the social medias, Instagram, Facebook, our website, theradicaltherapist.com, and also on Twitter. And come hang out and join us and be part of the community, etc. And then maybe hopefully share some of the stuff that we're doing so more people can learn about the Radical Therapist podcast. So that would be appreciated. And also, if you could, rate and review the show on iTunes. They tell me that helps. So please do that. Go, if you're listening to it right now on iTunes, go rate and review the show. That would be appreciated. So, okay, that's it. As always, I'm Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.